From the Danker Studio on Library Square, this is The Rundown, an exploration of local news, events, and issues that matter to you. Today on the program, we're going to have a conversation with Stuart Reed, the executive director of the American Food Co-op Initiative, to hear about the growth of member-owned businesses across the United States.
The bottom line has to be there in order for the co-op to be successful and to continue in business. So, you know, that money goes back to the owners and contributes to typically higher pay for employees and more training opportunities and more advancement opportunities, because all of the jobs are in the local community. There's not a corporate headquarters that has the high-paying jobs.
That conversation, plus a legislative update from the Utah League of Women Voters, and your summary of today's top local headlines, just ahead on The Rundown, here on KCPW. Welcome back to The Rundown. I'm Roger McDonough. Coming up later in the program, we'll have a conversation with Stuart Reed of the American Food Cooperative Initiative to hear about the growth of member-owned businesses across the United States. But first up, we have these headlines. Spencer Cox has cleared his first hurdle to becoming Utah's new lieutenant governor after receiving the unanimous endorsement of a state Senate committee. Governor Gary Herbert appeared at the committee hearing Tuesday afternoon to support Cox, his pick to replace Greg Bell, who is stepping down. Cox is a 38-year-old freshman lawmaker, attorney, and telecommunications executive from the small town of Fairview in central Utah. He's also a former mayor and council member of Fairview and former San Pete County commissioner. Cox's appointment must receive final approval from the Senate, which is scheduled to vote on the matter Wednesday afternoon. The cost of removing a cataract, between $2,000 and $4,000, is prohibitive for many, leaving them to struggle with a completely curable form of blindness. The Moran Eye Center has started a charitable surgery day to help restore sight to some Utahns. KCPW reporter Kim Shusky has the story.
According to the World Health Organization, in 2010 there were 20 million people who had become blind because of cataracts. That's half of the world's blind population. Jeff Petty is an ophthalmologist at the University of Utah Moran Eye Center. He says many kinds of blindness, including that caused by cataracts, can be fixed.
80% of blindness in the world is either curable or preventable. And 90% of the blindness is in developing nations, but we have a lot here, I mean, among us. And this is a place where there's no reason anyone should be walking around with preventable or curable blindness.
But they are. Barbara Simon's vision has been impaired by cataracts for around 7 or 8 years.
It's hard to see and read, and I haven't driven a car for a while, and I trip a lot.
Barbara doesn't have insurance and doesn't have the money to pay for cataract surgery on her own. Until recently, she was homeless. She receives health and eye care at the 4th Street Clinic in downtown Salt Lake City. Christy Chambers is the CEO of the clinic.
What we do with people whose care goes beyond the primary care setting is we will do case management around finding specialty care for patients. That's a tricky thing. Case management is always difficult because you're never sure if you can find it. But we do our best to try to match up the medical needs with people in the community and agencies in the community who are willing to participate in that.
And that's how Barbara found herself at the Moran Eye Center last weekend, waiting with 18 other patients for cataract surgery provided by volunteers. There were dozens of volunteers, from surgeons and anesthesiologists to nurses and admitting staff, that took part in what the center calls Charitable Surgery Day. Petty started Surgery Day 2 years ago with a fourth-year medical student after they realized how many people at the 4th Street Clinic and other clinics where they volunteer needed help.
We just had a big backlog of patients we were seeing who needed surgery. They were either had low vision or were blind, and all they needed was surgery, but we were just having trouble figuring out a way to give everyone the care they needed.
Cataracts form in the lens of the eye and can lead to total blindness.
So when we're born, the lens inside of our eye is crystal clear. And as we age, the lens just becomes progressively cloudier. Each year will become cloudier and cloudier. In its most advanced form, a cataract will completely block light entering the eye, and so someone won't be able to see you move your hand in front of their face.
The lens is an incredible work of nature. The organizations of cells and crystalline proteins within the cells of the lens are critical for the transparency of the tissue. When this structure becomes disorganized, the lens becomes opaque and can no longer efficiently transmit and focus light on the retina.
As we age with sun damage and other things, diabetes can also accelerate cataracts. The structure inside, the protein structure, can change. And so as more and more proteins are created and connections are disrupted, you have a crystal structure that breaks down and no longer transmits light clearly.
Surgery is the only remedy for cataracts. Petty says advances in the procedure have made it quick and painless because they only make two small incisions in the eye.
Through the 2-millimeter incision, we'll take the roof off of the lens and then enter into the lens with an ultrasound machine that breaks up the lens, which is at this point fairly dense and hard. The ultrasound breaks it up, and there's also an aspiration port, which will vacuum what you've broken up.
Before the lens is broken up, it's about the size of an M&M. After removal, they put in an artificial lens made out of acrylic or sometimes a plexiglass-type material.
And we'll essentially put their glasses prescription in a lens inside of their eye, and then we vacuum out anything we've left behind. And at this point, the incisions are so small, there's no sutures at all. The wounds will seal on their own, and the patient goes home the same day.
Once the affected lens has been removed and replaced, the patient will never get a cataract in the same eye again. Old age is the primary risk factor for cataracts, but smoking, diabetes, UV radiation, and certain medications such as corticosteroids also increase the risk of developing cataracts. It's rare for young people to get them, but 22-year-old Jose Alamos has had them in both eyes, which in the past has impaired his ability to get a job. He already had surgery on one eye and was at surgery day to remove his second cataract. He says vision comes back fast, even overnight.
Oh, it was awesome being able to see. Actually being able to like reach far away and just see everything and actually see the clear faces on people now. It was great.
Petty says for him there's nothing better than seeing the look on a patient's face after taking the bandage off the next day.
In the case of some of these advanced cataracts today, we're taking someone who can't read anything, someone who hasn't seen the face of her grandchild in 2 years, and at the end of the day, she'll be able to read. She'll be able to see her grandkid's face. And that's just, there's nothing I think I've ever done or could do that could give me that sort of reward.
For KCPW and Explore Utah Science, I'm Kim Shusky.
Now on the rundown, we feature a preview of tomorrow's interim session of the Utah State Legislature with Jen Gonnelly, president of the Utah League of Women Voters.
Good afternoon, Roger. Tomorrow morning, interim committees have a chance to approve draft bills before the legislature's general session starts in late January. The League of Women Voters lobby corps will be observing and testifying at several committees at 8 o'clock and again at 10:15. All meetings are in the morning because the governor has called a special session at 2:30 for the legislators to authorize using state funds to make up for the federal government shutdown. Opening and operating national parks, monuments, and recreation areas, funding the child nutrition program and benefits for some furloughed employees would be covered. Wednesday morning at 8 a.m., the Education Committee will consider a draft bill sponsored by Senator Pat Jones called School Funding Through Income Tax Revisions. It would raise $400 million a year to improve public schools by eliminating one personal exemption for every taxpayer. That money would be divided directly among individual schools rather than going through the state education office. Each school's community council would decide how to use the money to improve its school, maybe by hiring a teacher's aide or a reading specialist, for example. Each school community council is made up of the principal, teachers, and parents, with parents making up the majority of the council members, and their plans would need approval by the local school boards. The Government Operations Committee will look at draft legislation setting up orderly procedures for investigating state officials accused of breaking election laws. This bill, probably prompted by the current allegations against Attorney General John Swallow, includes how to petition to ask for an investigation and procedures for special investigations by special counsels and ousting the official from office. Wednesday morning at 10:30, the Economic Development and Workforce Services Committee will discuss Utah Foundation's research report, Climbing Towards the American Dream, a second analysis of economic mobility in Utah. It analyzes the ability of Utahns to move up and down the economic ladder. The League invites you to join us at the legislature. Watch, listen, or contact your legislature online at Utah's legislative website, le.utah.gov. For more information and to read the League's new study on funding of public education in Utah, visit the League of Women Voters website at lwvutah.org, and you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter.
You're listening to The Rundown here on KCPW. Stay with us. I'm joined in studio today by Stuart Reed. He's the executive director of the Food Co-op Initiative, a nonprofit group that works with retail food co-ops across the United States. He's in Salt Lake at the behest of the Wasatch Cooperative Market, who held their Dinner in the Field fundraiser over the weekend. So, Stuart, welcome.
Thank you.
And, you know, I thought we might just jump right into this topic by looking at what co-ops are and maybe also the history of co-ops in the U.S., if you can address that. Where do they come from and what are they all about?
Well, that's a long interview topic.
Perfect.
Where did they start in the United States? Well, the first co-op that's attributed in the United States was actually started by Ben Franklin. It wasn't a food co-op. It was a mutual insurance. And it still exists to this day. So our history of co-ops goes back all the way. And we have had strong food co-op movements since the early part of the 20th century. Particularly after the Great Depression or during the Great Depression when the need was there for people to find access to food that they wouldn't otherwise have had easily or couldn't afford. So people working together to meet common needs is really what drives co-op growth. And in addition to food co-ops, this country, of course, has a strong history of agricultural co-ops and producer co-ops, as well as some worker co-ops, and during, again, the Depression era and the big union movements, they were cooperatives that took over some of the industrial parts of our economy, and that did not last very long, but co-ops have been a part of the history of the United States.
And a co-op, I mean, basic definition would be member ownership or worker owner. I mean, give me a definition.
Yeah,
of what a co-op
well,
is.
Cooperatives are owned by the people that use the business or service or are the workers, as you said. And it's the worker cooperative, it's usually a service business of some kind where rather than working for an employer, the workers work for themselves and get the benefit of that work. In the consumer co-op, it's the people that are going to use the goods and services. And so for a food co-op, it's the members of the community that want to purchase healthy local food. In most cases, that's what they're looking for. And they band together and own a business to do that so that it meets their needs as opposed to the needs of some investor in a distant place or foreign country even that would whose primary goal would be to extract profit from the business rather than to meet a community need.
The co-op movement then is not just defined in opposition to say corporate control, but that is, I mean, is that part of the idea?
It isn't. It is in a way, I guess. We're not antagonistic about the rest of the economy, but we do wish people would take us a little more seriously. The co-ops are a very strong economic model. They tend to have a higher success rate. They bring more money back into their communities, and in general are just a very successful and workable model. We're an alternative to the corporate investment kind of economy in some ways, and a lot of people that is very attractive to. We've seen a lot of interest after the Wall Street, in the wake of the Occupy movement, a lot of people were thinking about where does their money being invested and why are we putting money into this culture that obviously is making money for a few people at the top and not really paying a lot of attention to the rest of us. So co-ops are an alternative to that. People went to credit unions, which are financial co-ops. And there also we saw a big uptick in the number of inquiries we got about starting new retail food co-ops.
Is the drive still to make profits?
The cooperative has to make a profit in order to be successful, like any business. The difference is that the profits go to the owners, and the owners are the people that use the service. So in a food co-op, at the end of the year, if there's enough profit that doesn't need to be reinvested in the business, it's distributed to the shoppers who are owners and on the basis of how much they spent in the store rather than how much they have invested. Mm. So, again, one of the key principles is that there's one vote per member and that it's a democratically controlled organization, not bought up by investors to control.
Okay, well, this is probably different for each location or co-op, but is a member, is one member defined as one individual person?
It can be. Sometimes it's an individual, sometimes it's a family or household. The co-ops can do treat that differently in some cases, but household is typical for food co-ops because, that's who's doing the shopping for one group of people.
You know, a restaurant could probably spend quite a good deal of money at a co-op over a given year, and then their return, if they did, if there was money to be returned, might be bigger than, say, an individual.
That's true. But we do find that while co-ops are happy to support or sell to other businesses like restaurants and cafeterias, they are not usually a tremendously large customer because they have their own wholesale outlets that they're buying from, and not buying from a retail store at a little bit, the price would be a little higher than if they went directly. But we are a great fill-in for a lot of those places that and have specialty products that they may not have access to. So it's part of the business.
And what about, maybe we could talk about the financial contribution of co-ops to the U.S. economy on the whole. You kind of touched on this, but do you have stats on how many co-ops there are, how big that contribution is, maybe just in terms of food co-ops, but also you could look at all of cooperative.
Yeah. Well, there are stats on that, and I'm afraid I'm not at the tip of my tongue for the greater co-op community, but it's in the billions of dollars. And in fact, the food co-op community alone, there are about 330 retail storefronts in the United States. And we estimate that that's something in the neighborhood of $1.5 to $2 billion in annual revenue that's going through that. Almost the same number of owner members. So a lot of people in this country are directly impacted by food co-ops. And if you take into account all the other kinds of co-ops, it's a very large percentage of credit unions and farm co-ops, and REI is a co-op, and all of the other kinds of co-ops that are out there. And all, no matter how what kind of co-op it is, I mean, what we're contributing to the community is the whole emphasis on meeting the needs. So if it's a food co-op, we're providing the kind of food the community wants and that may not be available otherwise. Supporting local farmers, putting money back into the local economy that way, other local businesses. The bottom line for has to be there in order for the co-op to be successful and to continue in business. So, that money is also goes back to the owners and contributes to typically higher pay for employees and more training opportunities and more advancement opportunities because all of the jobs are in the local community. There's not a corporate headquarters that has the high-paying jobs.
And I know that that's one of the arguments for the sort of local first movement is that, look, you're contributing to the profit stays here. It stays in the region where the money is being spent. Then that seems like it would be kind of equivalent in the co-op movement.
It's actually, I think, a little amplified. We typically see a multiplier effect of 1.6. For every dollar spent through a co-op, it's $1.60 of impact in the local economy. And that's a little higher than you usually see for a multiplier. So, again, not every community is exactly the same, but these are national statistics averaged out.
Yeah. How do co-ops tie into, say, the Local First movement or other initiatives to promote, agricultural sustainability or environmental sustainability on the whole?
Well, primarily through purchasing from local producers and farmers. Again, we do have average statistics, and I don't have them at hand, but we buy the typical co-op will buy about 20% or more of its entire inventory through locally sourced products. In a typical supermarket, it's down below 6%. So that's a big difference right there. And during seasonal peaks, that percentage is much higher, and depending, again, on what part of the country you're in. Here where you've got really good local farmers and producers for a variety of products, that percentage might very well be higher than it would be in, say, Fairbanks, Alaska, which just opened a co-op. But
just because of the season at which – the growing season.
Yeah, the growing season and the variety of products that are capable of being produced in the area. And you already have an existing strong, sustainable producer market. Some parts of the country are still developing that. So you're ahead of the game.
No, and I imagine that – for – obviously there are certain products that are impossible to get.
Sure.
Coffee's not grown in this region, for example.
No, the only place in the United States right now that you can get locally grown coffee is probably in Hawaii.
Oh, yeah. That would make sense. That would make sense. What about – so why did you come to Utah?
Well, we came to Utah because our organization, Food Co-op Initiative, has been provides support services for retail organizers like the Wasatch Co-op here. And we have part of our program is a small grant program to help provide resources for their so that they can acquire professional services they need that the local organizing group may not have themselves. And in this case, they're going to be using some of the funds we've made available for their market research. And when we work with a co-op that has gotten one of our seed grants, we always try to come and visit and say hi and meet people, provide some on-site support, and that's why we're here this week.
Great. You've said a lot about this already, that you know, it's local, it's contributing to the local economy. But if you had to, you know, if you're speaking to one listener out there right now who's thinking, oh, maybe this is something I'm interested in, you know, what would you tell them?
It would depend on the person.
Ah.
People have different motivations, but for most people, you know, the idea of being able to support the local economy right now is seems to be one of the main drivers. And you know, if you want to have access to some of the great local food that's out there, fresh, grown sustainably, it's not available in most of the other supermarkets in town, and you'll have a wide assortment along with the other kinds of food that you want. It'll be in this one place, and you don't have to worry about it changing in a year or two because it's the people in this community that will decide how this store looks and works. And you will be part of a social investment. You're investing in the community of Salt Lake City. You're not just buying a share of a business, which the ownership share of a co-op is a share, truly an ownership share of the business. This Wasatch Co-op, when it opens, will have over 1,000, probably closer to 2,000 individual owners. And that's a pretty unique business model.
Can investors get involved in co-ops?
In some ways, they can. There are some co-op models that have specific allowance for outside investors in larger amounts of money. They're a little controversial because it goes a little bit away from the original principles of democratic control. But even in the typical co-op organization, the members who have already bought their ownership share will usually be asked to help provide the other capital needed to start the business, either through making loans to the co-op or by buying non-voting shares. So those they might be able to invest a few thousand dollars, for example, in additional shares of the co-op that don't give them any extra voting control but would pay a small dividend or up to 8% maximum as the co-op becomes profitable in the future. So if you're looking at investing money, you can invest it in Wall Street for 3% if you're lucky, or you can invest it in your local co-op, and you're doing something great for the local economy. You know where your money is, and you're probably going to see the same rate of return.
What kind of pushback does the co-op movement get?
It depends, again, on where we are in the country. It's not political in very many ways anymore, at least. We've seen new co-ops start in very conservative military communities, for example, where people from the local base were instrumental in starting the co-op. People from all kinds of political stripe and ethnic backgrounds and political differences come together around the shared need that the co-op meets. And so we don't get pushback in that area so much. Where it typically comes is around price. And it's very difficult to be economically fair to all of the stakeholders and still be the low-priced option in town. Now, I think co-ops can easily document that they're fairly priced and that they're competitive with other natural food retailers.
Right.
But they're not low-priced outlets.
Right. Well, and I guess the reason they're not low-priced outlets is because the point isn't to just do the cheapest thing in the world.
Correct. That's the triple bottom line. We want to have a profit for the business so it can be sustainable. We want to be environmentally responsible as a business and meet the social needs of our community by outreach and education. Co-ops do that as a commitment. They'll provide educational events and work within their community in many ways beyond just being there as a retailer. So they become a social hub. They become the third place, if you're familiar with that concept. You have traditionally people have had their home, their church or religious establishment, and some third place, which is where they've the pub, the bowling alley, some place where they meet with their friends. And in a lot of modern society, that third place isn't there anymore. But the co-op's filling that niche for people in many communities. Get together and feel good with each other. You don't go shopping at a co-op. You go out to talk to your friends and buy groceries while you're at it.
Wonderful. Well, Stuart Reed, I want to thank you for coming in and taking the time to speak with us today.
Oh, thank you.
That was Stuart Reed, Executive Director of the American Food Co-op Initiative, a nonprofit organization working on building food co-ops across the U.S. You can find this interview and all of the conversations we have on the program at our website, kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for tuning in. We'll be right back. And thanks once again for tuning in to The Rundown this afternoon. Our show was produced by Lauren Colucci. We had additional help from Jesse Ellis and Tyler Ford. Our theme music was composed by Tim Myers. Tune in tomorrow as we take a look at Utah's public lands policies and ambitions with University of Utah Wallace Stegner Professor of Law, Robert Keeter. I'm Roger McDonough. You've been listening to The Rundown. The Utah Business Report and Marketplace are coming up next.